But because the finches in their beaks are so variable, many of them are so intermediate in appearance that they cannot safely be identified, a truly remarkable state of affairs. As the ornithologist David Lack sums up in his famous monograph, Darwin's Finches, "In no other birds are the differences between species so ill-defined. Caution," says a modern field guide to the birds of the Galapagos. "It is only a very wise man or a fool who thinks that he is able to identify all the finches which he sees." At the Charles Darwin Research Station on the island of Santa Cruz, the staff has a saying, "Only God and Peter Grant can recognize Darwin's finches." Peter Grant, having studied his chaffinches, nuthatches, mice, and voles, wondered what makes some species of animals and plants hypervariable and others not. He wondered why some of the most variable species will vary even in their variability, with one flock full of eccentrics and another flock full of conformists. These were outstanding biological questions in the early 1970s when Grant began looking for his next research project. At the time, Peter was in charge of the research. Rosemary was in charge of logistics. Theoretical and mathematical biologists were advancing paper dragons at one another in the pages of learned journals. Grant wanted to watch what actually goes on in nature. What he needed was a group of hypervariable species, well-studied, variably variable, scattered across a set of remote and undisturbed locations. The Galapagos were ideal, he says. Darwin's finches were ideal. The Grants made their first trip to the Galapagos in 1973. That first year, they worked with one of Peter's postdoctoral students, Ian Abbott, and his wife, Lynette, among others. To the bemusement of Peter's and Rosemary's families in England, the Grants also brought their two daughters, Nicola and Thalia, then aged 8 and 6. The girls had already camped with them in Greece, Turkey, and Yugoslavia to watch nuthatches. In those young field days, Rosemary's biggest job was catching Nicola and Thalia. They found the birds as tame as in the days of Darwin, or of the shipwrecked Bishop Berlanga in 1535, who marveled at the birds, which did not fly from us but allowed themselves to be taken. This is one of the strangest things about the Galapagos, after the strangeness of the animals themselves. And almost everyone who has ever written about the islands exclaims at it, including Cowley the buccaneer and Lord Byron, successor to the poet, who stopped there while returning a dead Polynesian king and queen to the Sandwich Islands. Cowley wrote in 1699, "Here are also abundance of fowls, viz. Flamingos and turtle doves, the latter whereof were so tame that they would often alight upon our hats and arms, so as that we could take them alive, they not fearing man, until such a time as some of our company did fire at them, whereby they were rendered more shy." Byron wrote in 1826, "The place is like a new creation. The birds and beasts do not get out of our way. The pelicans and sea lions look in our faces as if we had no right to intrude on their solitude. The small birds are so tame that they hop upon our feet, and all this amidst volcanoes which are burning round us on either hand. The finches are much more afraid of hawks and owls than they are of us," Peter Grant tells friends in Princeton. "When we walk up to them, the birds keep doing what they are doing. But when an owl comes near, they head for a cactus tree. A little while ago, Rosemary was crossing a treeless spot. An owl flew over her, and finches flew up from all around and landed on Rosemary. They are always perching on our shoulders, our arms, our heads. Sometimes when I am measuring one, a few others land up and down my wrists and arms to watch. I was looking out to sea with binoculars once, and a hawk landed on my hat. We have a picture of it." "Or you can pick up a bamboo pole, set it over your shoulder, and begin to carry it," says Rosemary. "Suddenly the pole is very hard to hold up. You are walking along wondering why it is so heavy. Then you turn around and see that you have a hawk hitching a ride on the back of it. I used to have a wart on my back, although it is gone now," says Peter. "A small black wart up near the right shoulder. I went around in just shorts in those days, and on Genovesa, finches would peck at the wart." "What a difference," says one veteran of the finch watch, Dolph Schluter. Schluter coined some of the team's favorite names for itself, including El Grupo Grant, the Finch Unit, and, for maximum grandeur, the International Finch Investigation Unit. In Kenya, Finches flush as much as 30 meters away. In the Galapagos, the birds land on the rim of your coffee cup. If there's only a little coffee left in there, they will land right inside it and take a sip. You can put your hand over it and measure the bird. Mockingbirds on Genovesa would pick at our shoelaces. On the really isolated islands like Wolf, you could catch the birds by hand. Just reach out your hand and grab them. Peter, camping in Shiraz, had once spotted a pair of nuthatches feeding near a rock. He put a few nuts on the rock and hid himself, hoping to observe the birds' beaks and feeding behavior at close range. Although he waited 3 hours, the birds did not come back. It would be better to use caged birds, Peter noted tersely in his report. But on Daphne, the most famous beaks in the world were tapping him on the shoulder. He had Darwin's finches perching on his knee, studying him. Peter was keenly aware that despite the birds' fame, despite their central place in the history of his field, no one had ever spent much time actually watching them. Darwin's insights were strictly retrospective. David Lack's were based mostly on inferences, museum specimens, and 4 months in the field. Bob Bowman had camped in the islands for less than a year. I think very quickly Peter saw the Galapagos as a gold mine, says Schluter. Not just a wonderful place to be, but a gold mine, a treasure chest. Today, looking down the road at what one could argue was the most successful field study of evolution ever carried out, you ask yourself, just how early in the game could Peter have foreseen all this, 20 years ago? I think maybe he had a glimmer of it from the beginning. That first year, the Grants and the Abbots planned to stay in the islands for only a single season, so they worked fast, despite the heat. They studied 21 populations of Darwin's finches on 7 islands. At each site at dawn, they unfurled 2 or 3 mist nets. Mist nets look rather like badminton nets on bamboo poles, but of so gossamer a weave that they are almost invisible to birds. The team left the mist nets up throughout the cool of the morning. They furled them again when the island got so hot that the birds trapped and struggling in the nets were in danger of overheating. Most days it was that hot by 8 o'clock in the morning. The members of the team went to work on each finch they caught in much the same style they do today, armed with dividers, calipers, and a spring balance. No one had ever subjected Darwin's finches to so many different measurements and indignities, and no one had ever measured so many finches. Over the years, in fact, the Grant team's measurements of live Darwin's finches have far surpassed the number of specimens in the world's museums. Off the island of Isabella, for example, there is a group of 4 small islands known as Los Hermanos, the Brothers. In Los Hermanos alone, Trevor Price eventually measured twice as many living, breathing specimens of fuliginosa as repose today in museums. The Grant team has also measured virtually every one of the thousands of museum specimens. In a study of variation, everything hinges on the accuracy of the measurements. Some subjects, the dome of the shell of a turtle, the webbed feet of a duck, the diaphanous gills of a fish, are hard to measure accurately. You measure once and measure twice, and your first number is quite different from the second. If the measurements are only good give or take a few percent, and if variations from individual to individual are much smaller than that, your study is doomed from the start. Fortunately, the finches and their beaks turned out to be not only easy to catch, but also easy to measure. A long series of finch watchers could go back and measure the same bird, and they would all get numbers within a fraction of a percent of each other. Weight turned out to be unreliable because a bird's weight goes up and down with the time of day and the time of year. But for other measurements, the difference was almost always very small. For beak length, it was only 0.1%. Hard facts are those rare details in this confusing world that have been recorded so clearly and unambiguously that everyone can agree on them. The shape of a finch's beak is a hard fact. The finch unit's measurements not only confirmed but heightened these birds' reputation for variability. They began to reveal how extraordinary Darwin's finches really are. The beak of the sparrow makes a useful comparison. Sparrows are closely related to Darwin's finches. Some taxonomists place all sparrows and finches in the same family. One of Peter Grant's field assistants that first year was the Canadian biologist Jamie Smith. Ever since the early 1970s, Smith and his own team have been conducting a parallel watch, measuring song sparrow beaks on the tiny, remote island of Mandart, British Columbia. Smith has found that the beaks of song sparrows on Mandart are all nearly the same length. It is rare to find a beak that is even 10% away from the mean. The probability of finding a sparrow that is deviant is about 4 in 10,000. But in the Galapagos, the finch unit has discovered, the probability of finding a cactus finch with a beak 10% from the mean is much better than 4 in 1,000. It is 4 in 100. One of the Grant's world records in this respect is the depth of the upper mandible of the medium ground finch on Daphne Major. Here, the probability of finding a 10% deviation is 1 in 3. That is one of the most variable characters ever measured in a bird. And Darwin's finches are extraordinarily variable, not only in the depth, length, and width of each mandible, and in the relative lengths of the upper and lower mandibles, but also in their wingspans, their body weights, and the length of their legs. Darwin's finches are even variable in the length of the hallux, or big toe. Again, Darwin did not realize that these finches are so extraordinarily variable because he did not collect enough of them to find out. Nor would Darwin have expected this result. He thought a small population would offer fewer variations from which nature can select. Hence, he assumed that natural selection would be especially slow on a tiny oceanic island like Daphne Major. So even during their first season, the Grants and Abbotts could see that Darwin's finches were more interesting than Darwin dreamed. And during that first field season, the island of Daphne Major sent the finch watchers an omen, a sign, a token of the difference a millimeter can make. One day in April of that first year in the Galapagos, after a hard day measuring finch beaks, Ian Abbott climbed down to the welcome mat on Daphne Major to take in the view. The ledge is always encrusted with barnacles, each one a crude model of Daphne itself, a cone with a hole at the top. Because Abbott was sharing the ledge with these large, sharp barnacles, he wore a pair of old shoes. But because his wife and Peter Grant were the only other human beings on the island at that moment, Abbott wore nothing besides the shoes. It was 6 o'clock in the evening, and the tide was coming in. Abbott squatted on his haunches, watching as the sun set on the neighboring island of Santa Cruz, and as hundreds of seabirds beat their way back to their roosts on Daphne Major. 1 millimeter beneath the future of Ian Abbott's genetic lineage, a single barnacle towered above all the rest. And as the first waves lapped the welcome mat, this great white barnacle opened its lid, extruded its feather duster, bumped into something, and nipped shut as powerfully as only a behemoth among barnacles can. At least, this is how they tell it now on Daphne Major, where the story is still passed down from one generation of finch watchers to the next. They say Abbott screamed, Abbott bellowed, Abbott danced up and down on the welcome mat. At that moment, he hated a barnacle as no man ever had before.